I'm Sonia Sicanto, and this is my podcast, Unseen: Legacies of Childhood. Today on Unseen: Legacies of Childhood, I'll be speaking to Hassan Rahmani. Hassan is a digital content producer with Amnesty International. It's no wonder that Hassan worked for a human rights organisation, as at 10 years old, Hassan was forced to flee his native home for a new life in the UK due to the Kosovan War. I can't imagine how terrifying this must have been for a young boy, or what the lasting legacies of war are on children. In this episode, Hassan opens up about the reality of war for him. But he also talks of his experiences of those first months and years of life in the UK as a refugee. It's a story that will stir up emotions. So tissues at the ready. Hey, Hassan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on to my podcast, Unseen: Legacies of Childhood. Lovely to have you on.
Good to be here.
I want to hear all about you and your childhood. So could you start from the beginning? Could you start pre-war?
So basically, just to give you some background, originally I come from Kosovo, and in 1999, where all the trouble started, Kosovo was part of what was then called Yugoslavia. We were we used to be part of the country, numerous countries that belonged to Yugoslavia. And then eventually this country started to break up from Yugoslavia, resulting in conflict. We were one of the last countries to try and do so, to break up from Yugoslavia. And in the end, we faced war. Looking back now, I had a very happy childhood, despite living under an occupation and being treated as a second-class citizen. We lived a very happy life, mainly because my parents sort of shielded me from a lot of the troubles that were happening. But also, I think bringing up children in this part of the world during that time was freer. There was no internet. There was no advice. You just got on with it. And, we played, outside and with nature, with whatever, football all day, in the evening.
Were you in a city, or were you based?
Yeah, we were on the outskirts of the city. So I grew up in the capital of Kosovo, which is called Pristina. I think I was around the age of eight or nine, when I could sense that things were not right, because my dad would be always at home watching Serbian TV news on and getting angry with the events. And then the wars around the countries of Yugoslavia started happening. So the one that I started to remember was Bosnia, which was next door. So what would happen was, so the Serbs needed a lot of people to fight. And what they do is they made joining the Yugoslav military a condition for everyone. So basically you had to join. If you were of the age of 16, I think 16 to 18, you had to join. So what they would do is force the Albanians to join the Yugoslav army. And obviously the Albanians didn't want to join the Serbs to fight in a war that they didn't want to fight in. So a lot of youngsters who were Albanian were either fleeing or hiding, and then they would become sought after criminals because the state would see you as a traitor for deserting the army. So what happened was from a sort of 93-94, and there was a wave of youngsters who fled Kosovo, primarily Albanian youngsters. So this is when my elder brothers left. This was the sort of the beginnings of things starting to break and things starting not to be as normal, where suddenly my two brothers weren't there. Suddenly my dad was just clued to the television and watching news and getting angry and angry. And then as I was reaching my sort of 10th birthday, I was realizing that, okay, things are not quite right. As a 10-year-old, you shouldn't be thinking like that. When I look back now and reflect on the childhood, there's so many key moments that occurred that I think I shouldn't have had to have done that. I shouldn't have,
Like what?
For example, not seeing your brother for almost 20 years, or always, when we were going to school, for example, the Serbs had banned Albanians from going to state schools. So they only, and so basically if you were, like, doing your GCSEs, for example, you know, the equivalent of GCSEs in secondary school, you'd had to go to an Albanian house. So Albanians started a parallel education system in people's homes where they were teaching children education and history and Albanian history. So we ran a sort of a parallel system because the Serbs were shutting down. The only place the Serbs... what I mean by the Serbs is the Serbian army and the police mm-hmm. and the state. The only place they wanted us to go to was mosques because they wanted to create a narrative that we are this European Muslims who pray, who are so backward. But the reality was that the Albanian community is very diverse and we're sort of, religion doesn't play a major role. It's ethnicity that does. It's first you're an Albanian, right. Ethnic Albanian, and then religion sort of is a very a secondary attribution to our nation, where you only become religious really when you're getting a little bit old and you sort of fear that you're going to die, so you start going to mosque. It's a bit like that, you know. So and it's a very secular state there, you know, and you could have a household, for example, when someone will fast Ramadan and then the brother is an alcoholic drinking and they're like live together. So you have these instances. So just I wanted to provide some context in that side. Things started to change drastically, you know, every year. So first was the school. So because I was still in a sort of reception primary school, I would go to the main school, but after the Serbs had finished. So this would be late during the day. So, for example, in the winter, we'd go to school at 4 or 5 p.m. and it was already dark, and then the Serbs would cut off the heating, so we had no radiators, mm-hmm. so we'd be in a cold school. So there was all this constantly, these little things that made sure that you are felt that you're a second-class citizen. If you were walking on a street, for example, as a child, I would be 10 or 11 going to a shop. And if I saw a policeman, if I didn't give way or change, they'd slap you or do something to tell you that, you know. So suddenly this fear starts building up. You start fearing institutions. You know, you go to get a document with your father, and you can see that your father is afraid to be there. You get stopped by police. So my father would, you know, we would go visit aunts and uncles or whatever outside of Pristina, and on the way back, we'd get stopped by the police at sort of 10, 11 p.m. when we'd be asleep in the back of a car, and they'd take us out and search the car. And
that must have made you feel very unsafe, was it?
So this was sort of the fear built gradually with layers. So then you build this anxiety that sort of doesn't leave you, and then it shapes who you are later on in life, which I found out, which we probably will get into. But it's this fundamentals that you know that they instill in you, and this is all because the society is being created that is unequal, and one is not as on par with the other. Basically, just to give you a quick recap, the childhood was great. I was loving it, and it was so, you know, eating organic food, running around, playing, fighting, falling over, hurting yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. And then slowly these things happening in waves, in like year after year. And for me, then I started sort of changing and sort of leaving the childhood behind, but I was still a child. And what happened there was, for example, I started paying less attention to football or playing outside, and more attention to the news that my dad was watching, because I could see that things were not right. You know, we'd be, for example, in my neighborhood in Pristina, we'd be playing and then there would be smoke in the background, and it would be like, well, the war is coming closer. We had a political leader at the time called Ibrahim Rugova, and his ethos, his mission was, we cannot let ourselves fight against Serbs because they will slaughter us or kill us like they did in Bosnia, which was next door. So he didn't want us to confront the Albanians of Kosovo, to confront the Serbs with you know, fighting. He wanted to do it through peaceful means, through going to the UN, asking for help, going to see John Pope II at the time, and things like that. So the Albanians were patient and patient, and eventually, you know, youngsters who were growing up in this society were going, well, this is not working. So that's when in late 97, the first wing of the Kosovo Liberation Army was formed, where this man in balaclava started appearing in Albanian magazines and saying things like, we want equal rights, we want to have an independent Kosovo. And then they started this guerrilla war where they would attack Serbian police every and then run away, and then the Serbs would retaliate by going into an area and just completely destroying a whole village and burning things. And so with Kosovo is a very small country by land. It's a tiny, it's the size of London and outskirts. With a population of 2 million, about 92% Albanian and 8% of Serbs and other ethnicities. So the Serbs were just the sort of the 8% of that population would control the rest of us, and they would go and burn villages and cause heinous crimes. I mean, they were experienced because they had done similar things in Bosnia and Croatia in their wars within Yugoslavia. So what happened was, as this fighting grew and more attacks from KLA happened against Serbs, the Serbian police and paramilitary just grew too. So the Slobodan Milosevic, who was the leader at the time of Yugoslavia, he diverted his forces to Kosovo. But what he also did is he gave free rein to whoever was a nationalist, whoever believed in his idea of this greater Serbia, to pick up arms and fight. They had this paramilitary groups, sort of, you had various ones. You had like the Tigers, who were led by this notorious guy called Arkan. You had all sorts of these criminals who would cause carnage in Albanian communities, would go and loot them, rape women. I mean, we were hearing horror stories. So again, now coming back to me as a child, I'm sitting there, you know, every evening at home, and I'm hearing the stories of awful things happening around villages, Albanian villages. Against that backdrop, it was very hard to be a child. It was very hard to then go and play football and play with you just couldn't do it. So it's sort of your childhood leaves you. You're like the spirit of a child leaves you, and you become this weird person where you are. I was this tiny boy with a sort of voice of a mouse, I'd imagine all sorts of scenarios. I'd just go and lock myself in a corner and think. So the problem is, these things, the traumas, the psychological effects that war has, you're not prepared to deal with this. No one, you know, my mum and dad they don't understand what psychology is. You know, they just, so it was sort of survival mode for everyone, and the parents did what they thought was right for you. So it was.
You had to manage yourself, did you?
Exactly. Yeah. So from around 98, the things started to drastically escalate, and it was that it was in tandem as the political conflict was rising. That was the same with me. My childhood was changing, so it was in tandem, in parallel. And then, come 98, middle of 98, things just sort of erupted, and then I hit on sort of full on sort of conflict mode, where things were not the same anymore. You had to just, you know, we were just waiting, when is it going to happen? You know, when are we going to get kicked out? My childhood sort of stopped in 97.
It must be horrific. I mean, just sitting there waiting for it to come to you.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't particularly. The thing is, you're sort of numb to these things, and you don't really. You're expected to be a child, but you don't. You know, I remember. Just to skip forward a bit, when we were eventually kicked out, and then I ended up as a refugee in Macedonia. I'll go into more details in that, but I remember like having toys and things, and just they meant nothing, you know, footballs, like the things that I was crazy about, and car toys and things like that. I was just didn't care. All I wanted to do was sit down. Yeah, all I wanted to do was sit down and watch the news. And now, having children and seeing my kids grow up differently, it's in a way it's a blessing, because I'm kind of reliving the missed childhood through my children, which is
how does that impact how you approach parenthood even?
I've had to untangle some of my stuff that or preconceptions that I had, or relearn a few things. Obviously, naturally, being a parent is a shock, you know, coming from an adult where I had like quite a secured life eventually, you know, yes. And a happy life. Suddenly you have children and you go, oh my God. And in my case, having children I am the first to have a child that is non-Albanian, and I broke okay. that sort of mold and yes. sort of settled in a multicultural society that's completely different to where I come from. So that was completely different. And just seeing, for example, children do things that remind me of what I used to do. For example, the way my son runs now and he gets excited about football, it's how I remember doing things. So it's things like that make me happy. But also, I can see that he's going to get to the age where my childhood stopped. And for me, it's kind of like, at least I get to see.
It's a sweet.
Yeah. Mm. At least I get to see what that childhood was like, and makes me happy that I can do that. I'm alive. And I can do that. So it's I think it's a good thing.
That's a blessing, isn't it? It's a gift. So when we go back to where you were in Pristina, when the war came, how did you escape?
I remember very, very clearly. I mean, now we're 26 years on or something like that. I was in the living room without electricity. It was all dark. We were a candlelit room, and you had this, like, you know how we had just one candle, and it was like, because people were moving and it was waving. So we had this like flicker of dim light coming in and bouncing of the walls. Yeah. And you could just about see the faces of my mum and dad and my brother.
Gosh, and it was quite scary, isn't it, for a young child?
And I remember the phone rang, and it was my brother in the UK, who was in the UK at the time. He had gone from Sweden to the UK. And he'd phoned in because he was watching the planes leave the military base in Italy, in Aviano. And basically he said, look, you've got an hour or so and the planes are coming. NATO is starting their bombing campaign. And my dad sort of spoke to him. I remember he was talking to him and he said, okay, and said bye to him. And it was like a sort of, you know, goodbye. It must have been a tough call to make for my brother, you know. Sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional because reliving these things, it's tough.
Of course.
But these stories should be told, and I'm glad that you touched on it. But my father, I remember he's, you know, hanged up the phone and he sort of just looked like to the wall, and I could tell that things were changing very quickly. And he sort of said, like, all right, that was our son Eki, you know, and he said that the NATO has started the bombing campaign and we will be bombed very quickly. And then shortly after that, I remember, I think it was about 10 p.m. or something like this, 10 or 11 p.m. we started hearing these sirens, and it was the first time this war sirens of like, wee! Like, and this was the Serbs warning other Serbs to go and seek shelter, but we had no shelter. We were just there, you know. And then suddenly, within, it wasn't half an hour after that phone call, when the sky started changing color, which is becoming white. You just saw the sky changing color, and then you hear the sound coming after, and you hear this like fast whizzing sound, and then you'd hear, and then the whole ground would shake, and it was just horrendous. And then the glasses like on the windows would start like shaking, and it was quite, I remember thinking, you know, this, just thinking like, what, I need to hide somewhere, but there was no hiding space, there was nowhere to go. I just had to sit down and listen to the adults talk, and there was just speculation, you know. They were like, oh, this is going to happen now. So I had two of my uncles who just were stranded at that night, who happened to be in our house. They couldn't go home in their village, so they stayed with us. So imagine they were cut off from their families, their kids, and so they were just staying with us. And then was my mum and dad and my brother, my two brothers and me. You could see the movement of the Serbian forces. Started like moving their tanks into Albanian neighborhoods and parking them in people's garages so that NATO could bomb a civilian area, and then they'd say, look, NATO is killing innocent people and all this stuff. So whilst NATO was bombing, the Serbs were remaneuvering, and then they would shoot at us like with snipers from the opposite valley. They would shoot at us. So during the night, we'd have to be super, super, like, just pray to God that NATO doesn't hit us. And then during the day, we were expecting retaliation. So during the day, the Serbs would basically go into Pristina neighborhoods and kick people out. And basically, that was the retaliation. You bomb us, we're going to kick everyone out. 2 weeks later, basically, Serbian police in Balaklava jumped over a fence in our house and slowly kicked us out. But I remember so vividly when it happened, because we had gone through about, I think it was 7 or 8 days or something like that, of bombing during the night, and then during the day watching the Serbs kick people out. And then eventually they arrived to us slowly.
Of course. And you kind of knew that was coming, didn't you?
It was coming, but there was nothing we could do. We could, you know, we had packed essentials. So we had a bag with food. And I remember being so scared that my muscles were just shaking. Like, I have never had that trembling fear ever. I've never experienced fear so deep that your muscles just tremble. Like, you know, when you sometimes, if you watch a horse and they have like an insect on them, they shake their muscles. It was like that. It was like that. My whole body just trembling with fear. And you couldn't stop it. It was all internal. And so... That pretty much happened constantly for about 8 to 9 days, day and night, you know. And I remember
you said, didn't you, that you put on all your clothes because you're so scared about leaving anything behind.
I was I got so scared, and I was thinking, imagining all the scenarios that they're gonna either butcher us or they're gonna take us somewhere in the mountains, because in the news you just saw always refugees in mountains hiding. So I thought, oh, we're gonna be cold. So I went upstairs into my room and just put every single cloth I could find until I couldn't, like, I had about 7 or 8 layers, and I didn't tell anyone, and obviously no one was paying attention to me. So I remember feeling really, really hot and just thinking, like, I hope the Serbs come and kick us out, because it's like really hot in here. So, you know, and then eventually I think my mum tried to pick me up, and then she was like, oh God, and she looked at me and I had all these clothes. And so she removed them, and she so reassured me, and she said, don't worry, we'll be okay. And then a day later or something like that, I remember my mum had just, it was catching an afternoon nap, you know, because you get tired of watching the war, you know. So, and then I was in the sort of outside the front garden, and I could see in my uncle's house, which is next door, I could see this like men in green uniform just jumped over the wall, and they looked really big, and they had like grenades hanging on their back and big knives, like Swiss big army knives. And they had balaclavas on, and they were like moving very swiftly towards us. And I went, oh, ooh, God. And then I went and was in a living room and said to my mom and dad, like, they're here. The Serbs are here. And then we sort of made for the exit gates of our house. And then we jumped in the car as fast as we could. And, the car was already packed with sort of blankets and essentials. And my brother and I jumped in the back seat. My eldest brother, second eldest brother, Mentor, he had been at my other uncle's house at the time. So he wasn't with us when we were leaving. So it was just me and my brother. And my mom and dad, we got in a car and started to drive as fast as we can to sort of leave the soldiers behind. And then they eventually caught up with us. It was about 5 minutes into the journey. It was, this is very narrow streets, it was unpaved. And we were about, I'd say about 500 meters away from the soldiers when they shot at us there. So my dad, I remember he had seen it in his rearview mirror. So he kept shouting, lie down, like put your heads down. Like, oh, he was just like ordering us to put our heads down. So my brother and I sort of like lying down, and you just hear the sound of bullets like whizzing past. You hear this ping, ping, and I think my dad stopped the car, and we sort of opened the door and just crawled like outside and got in front of the car and just crawled in. And then we could see in front of us. So our road joins with via the, another road that goes down and eventually leads to a main road. So we could see the masses going down. So they were being ethnically cleansed neighborhood. But so we sort of crawled and ran to join those masses. And then once we joined them, we were in a sort of line of four, like each family was in like line of four, just walking down holding bags. And then we became that image that I saw in the news. You know, we were those people holding bags and knowing where to go. And then shortly after we left, I remember one of my neighbors saying, oh, my dad's name was Emin. So my neighbor said, oh, Emin's house has just been set on fire. So again, I was conjuring up these images of, you know, what I saw in the news. So I remember just fainting. I just literally let go. My legs let go and I fainted. And the next thing I know, some guy was sort of washing my face and slapping me, some neighbor, and saying like, you're okay. And then I sort of got myself together again and started walking. We just walked for about 3 miles, just walked the line sort of 4x4. And all you could hear.
How did you do that? I mean, you were only 12.
You had no choice. Wasn't big of a walk because we were walking to this train station, but at the time we didn't know where we were going, so we just kept walking, and it was this eerie silence. I mean, I have never ever experienced that kind of silence. There was all these people on the road, you know, thousands and thousands of people, children, old people, you know, and no one was making a sound. It was just, all you could hear was just the sound of a tank driving up and down somewhere, and that was it, and some birds here and there. There was no reporters, there was no camera, there was no one. It was just the Serbs exercising ethnic cleansing, and that was it. This was in this particular time in Pristina, in this area. And then eventually we reached, we were reaching the town center, and we were going past this place where a lot of the Serbs used to live. This eerily quiet atmosphere was suddenly like got louder because the Serbs who was living in these flats were playing Serbian music, like part sort of turbo folk music, and they were throwing acid from their balconies to us, to the masses below. So we were sort of trying to avoid this puddles of acid, a bleach that was coming down onto us from the Serbs who were like just randomly.
Did anyone get hit that you knew?
I didn't see any incidents of like acid. I just saw like, you know, people getting away. And then so we walked far enough so that we couldn't get hit by acid. Oh, good. And there was this kind of under the flat, there was this sort of trees that, and you were being blocked from. So we sort of survived there too. Mm. And then eventually, instead of turning left to the stadium, we walked and turned right to the train station. And that was a huge relief because we, at least we weren't getting killed for that time. And then the train station just sort of, we just waited there as masses from different areas started coming. And then just sort of the chaos started to ensue because suddenly you started seeing faces, you know, I saw my English school teacher was there, my uncle, my cousins, you started seeing everyone. And then it just became this sort of walkabout. You started walking around and people sort of discussing, because by this time we'd been isolated from everyone with no communication. And suddenly all these masses were coming together and going, oh my God, what's going on? So everyone was chatting, speculating, you know, thinking what's going to happen. And obviously
you're so lucky you didn't get separated.
So, well, I did, but I was lucky because I have, you know, coming from an Albanian family, we have big family. So, you know, I was there with my uncles and 57 cousins, and, you know, this is just the first cousins. So it's like, you know, it's a huge family. So we were all sort of together there. And I remember this buses just started turning up. It was all set up and everything was sort of so imagine, the Serbs would have had some kind of logistical meeting about how do we kick, you know. So like when you look back, this was planned. This was organized by the Serbs to get us out. And I must say they planned it very well because they systematically emptied the whole city. Pretty much 98% of the city was emptied. So what they did is they put loads of people away. So as the neighborhoods were coming to the train station, they would load them into coaches and, a train came with sort of eight coaches, this Yugoslav train. And I remember my dad saying, well, there's no way we're going anywhere. We're going to sit put and we're going to wait to see if we can hear what's going, where are they taking them, and if you can make a... Basically, it's just sort of trying to decide what decision I can make so that it leads to us living. But then we missed the coaches and the train, and it was a sort of late afternoon. And then the night fell, and we were still at the train station, and it started getting cold. And it started, like, you hear children crying, and people started, and it was starting to, the cold started to creep in. And I remember the Serbs shooting, like the snipers above, shooting at us just to kind of keep an order. I remember lying next, putting my head next to my mum's lap, and my feet with the stones, and playing with the stones, kicking the stones of the railway. And I must have fallen asleep, or I was sort of tired. And it was about 2 a.m. and I could hear this, like, on the rail track, I could hear this, like, and there was a train, the train was coming back, and you could see this light getting bigger, and suddenly chaos ensued because people had to clear the track. And in that moment, I lost my family. So I lost contact with, basically, it was just chaos, everyone. And I remember the train arriving and just looking at this train. And then someone just grabbed me and shoved me through the window inside the train. And I got in the train, and suddenly the train had a sort of a narrow corridor, and then it had cabins of six people. And then I got in, climbed in, jumped into the corridor, and then sort of got myself together, and then walked into this cabin, and I was the only child there alone, and was thinking, oh, this is lovely and warm. And then suddenly the wave of people just filled up this, like, and I kept being pushed, and eventually ended up on the up carriage where you put your luggage. It was like I had my head was sort of tilted like that, and all I could do was kick. I could kick the window to open the window and then close it. That's all I could do. And next to me was one of my cousins. And then I kept shouting, where's my mom? Where's my dad? I couldn't. And I saw my uncle. I was like, where's my mom? Where's my dad?
You must have been
family?
Panicked by that stage.
And I could hear my father from next carriage going, we're here. Or someone saying to me, they are here. Like, your family's fine. They're next door. So I knew that they had made it on the train too. And I had my uncle, and then I was with my neighbors, with all the people I knew. So I was calmer. But then eventually we set off, and then everyone had to be quiet because the train was sort of moving on purpose and was camouflaged so that NATO thinks it's the army and they would bomb the train. So there was a few instances where refugees with tractors were bombed by NATO, who thought at the time that they were military. So the Serbs wanted this to happen. And eventually we arrived in Kosovo and Macedonia border, and the Serbs took us out and said, you have to walk on the railway tracks because it's all mined, and there's mines everywhere. So we all had to walk in two by two in a train, and saying, don't worry, you'll have your freedom now, in Serbian, saying you'll join people now, you'll have your freedom, you're safe. They were being all sarcastic I remember with my father and joining my father and holding his hand again after 8 hours of not seeing him, and then walking into this, it was sort of a valley, a big valley, and then between two countries, there was just a no man's land, and they were the people, we were joining the people who had been kicked out before, or earlier, day before and stuff. And there was just this, you could see where people were sitting down, their families had formed little places, and they had this blankets, dark blankets, and Red Cross was giving out blankets, and there was this trucks that were just throwing out bread. And I remember first thing was being hit by this barrage of reporters with being flashed on and all these people, just because we were the first to come out, and they were going, what have you seen? What have you seen? And I remember thinking, seeing recognizing CNN or something, or Reuters or something, logo. And I remember trying my hardest in a very broken English to explain, I was a child, trying to explain that what had happened, and, in a very broken English, trying to tell them, they were making notes. And I remember feeling really important. As soon as we sort of congregated in this place, but then we were getting to know families and all, everyone was starting to get together again, and people starting speculating who's left behind, who's missing, and this, I, the first time I started hearing this, people are missing. So people had lost contact with loved ones on the way, or had changed their journeys, or had gone in different ways. So there was no means of communicating. So
and there's no way of tracking or anything.
No, there was none of that. So the first times, you know, we started hearing about missing was this time, and we're like, oh, yeah. I'm missing a daughter, I'm missing an uncle, I'm missing a sister. It was just this kind of conversation happening, and then I remember my father trying to go to speak to the Macedonian authorities to see if he can find a corridor for us to go through and escape. But then he came back, and I remember he looked really distraught. He said, we're going to be here for a while because they're registering people as refugees and you're going to have to enter a system. Eventually, at a sort of midnight or something, it was like we had arrived at 8 a.m. or 6 a.m. in the morning, and then at midnight or 1 a.m. the day after, we were eventually put on this coach. And again, no idea where we were going. We just mm-hmm. were getting out. And then I remember we drove for, I think, about an hour or two, and then ended up in Gostivar, which is a town in Macedonia. It's populated by Albanians.
Right.
And we were put in the mosque. We were suddenly, we had to go to this mosque. And you know how mosques have this, like, open floor where everyone yeah. prays. So and that's where we went, and everyone had their own family perch. And I remember my dad sort of securing us all together and then going out to bring us burek, which is what locals had brought in, this like pastry.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, he brought me like a burek and a yogurt or something. And then I remember we're like, okay, let's go to sleep now. So we slept there, and it was the most peaceful sleep I've ever had, like in about months, because I knew that there was no chance of us getting killed.
Yeah.
And it just felt safe. And for some weird reason, it was very spiritual, very sort of like, I remember feeling really, it was amazing. It was a very, I remember feeling very like, wow, like it was such a spiritual moment. And then in the morning, my dad again had woken up before everyone else, and he was in the courtyard of the mosque. And basically Albanian families, Macedonians, so Albanians from Macedonia would come into the mosque courtyard and just declare and say, I have a house, I can fit in a family of five. And then a family of five would say, okay. And then they would take people as refugees, just like that. No contracts, yeah. just verbal sort of agreement without any kind of deadline. They would just say, come and stay with us. So I remember this this old man, sort of like he had a funny walk, this Albanian man, who spoke in a completely different Albanian dialect to us. Speaking to my father, and then my father come in saying, right, we're going to this man's house with another family, which was distant cousins. So we ended up in this strange man's house.
And were you nervous of going to this house, or were you okay? Because Dad said it was
never visited a stranger's house before, and they were speaking in this really random, the Albanian that I've never heard in my life. They were like, what is this Albanian? I could just hear every now and then I understood something, and then I'd lose them, and they would ask me something, and I'd go, what are they saying? Because they had a different dialect and a different accent. So They were amazing, this family, absolutely amazing. So they took us in, and first thing my dad and mum did is they needed to buy clothes, because we had nothing. We had like all this dirty clothes we were wearing for weeks. So my mum took all my clothes off and left me on this like underwear thing. I was 12, I was still a child, and said, like, we're going to go and buy you clothes, and I'm going to put this in a wash. And she put me in this like room we were staying, and she put this, in Balkans, they have this really woolly, fluffy blanket. They're really itchy and thick. And she put one of these over me, and I was just like in this stranger's house with this woolly thing. And I was like, what? And I was too embarrassed to get out of, you know. So I had to stay there for about 3 hours. And I remember I'd fallen asleep, and the family we were staying had a kid, about 5-year-old. And this kid had obviously seen that someone is in their house, and he had come into my room and didn't know what to do. So first, like, he slapped me and I was fast asleep. But I thought it was the Serbs who had come in. So I woke up in a panic, scaring this child.
Of course, he was scared.
It was both. Anyway, he became one of my good buddies, like a five-year-old that I sort of used to play with. But basically for 3 months, this family just fed us, looked after us, and we became a sort of, I don't know, we just became so attached to them.
Yeah.
But what happened day after, sort of a day or a couple of days after, as we started to settle into this family and his brothers who had taken my cousin's family, I remember one day, because again, this missing, we were watching the news constantly to see the Albanian news would have on the bottom, like on a ticker, about so-and-so family has been found, this other people, or this particular family with this members have died, these other people. And they would just have this information constantly. So you were getting updates sort of hourly from the ticker. And I remember the news coming on and the news reader in Albanian reading a sort of a breaking news about a massacre that had occurred in Kosovo in a village. And I think it was something like 16 or 18 members of my cousin's family who was with me at the time. They were being read out. So basically he was watching the news and his family was just being, he was being told by the media that he has nobody.
Oh,
and they were just being, they were reading his brother, his sister, his, you know, all. And I remember what was really shocking was, he had this like scruffy beard and long hair because he hadn't shaved and cut his hair in a while. And by the end of that news segment, he had sort of quietly pulled his hair off, like in it. And as a child watching that, it was just very poignant. It was just kind of like, phew. And I remember that stuck with me for, you know, it was, you know, but the guy just stood there and said nothing and just sort of took it in. And it was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. My eldest brother, Eki, he had fled, as we mentioned earlier, during this time when the Serbs wanted people to go in the army. So he had fled and he was in Sweden and eventually he ended up in the UK. And during that time, during 99, he was a student and he was making a documentary about Kosovo refugees. And he had come to Macedonia to film people because there were a lot of the Kosovars were ending up in refugee camps in Macedonia. And he had come to film for his uni project with his friends and colleagues. And he had got in touch with the Red Cross. And the Red Cross at the time were doing this thing where if you had a family member living in the UK, they would fast track your application so that you could leave Macedonia and then join the person in the West. And that was the system in place so that they could fast track people. And basically Red Cross extracted us from Macedonia into the UK. And this was the time when refugees and attitudes to refugees were completely different. We were lucky in the sense that Kosovo was in the news and the media was covering Kosovo heavily at the time. And we had a very positive, you know, a response as a result. So when we finally set off to come to the UK, when we landed in Leeds. It was June 99. I remember we entered this mini bus and we were driving to this place in Rotherham in Leeds. And at every traffic light, every traffic stop, we were being greeted with people clapping and because they knew. So it was an amazing welcome. It was like, wow, like, you know.
You just don't hear of that, do you?
No. And it's like, I have such a positive, warm memory of my entrance to the UK. So when nowadays when I speak to people and people ask me where you're from and I tell them I'm from Kosovo, they presume that I've sort of entered England through Dover or some kind of back of a bus or swam the channel or something, you know. But we came, you know, through legal means with the Red Cross and we were processed. And
were you all quite relieved then to be settled finally? This is your destination.
No, because my parents were just getting more and more upset because they were getting further and further from their home. The more I started to learn English, the more I started to sort of become my parents' parent because and the more my parents were losing their authority on me. So there was another battle that started happening. It's the sort of stuff you don't really see or hear when you hear stories about refugees, that the family dynamic, the family roles just completely breaks down. And especially when the family moves from their routine, from their normal day-to-day life. So eventually we settled in Rotherham, but then we found out that my uncle, my dad's brother, had moved to another place, to Manchester, in a village called Northwich. So we wanted to be near, again, not knowing what's going to happen to us. So we requested to move, and I remember we went on a train again, and there was a completely different train journey, because everyone from the ticket inspectors to the people in our offices, everyone knew who we were, and they helped us, and we changed. And it was the most wonderful. Even the passengers would like welcome us. And it was the most, I can't thank England enough for that. You know, it's something that is, it's omitted in the British media. You never hear a refugee saying, I'm so thankful, or I'm so proud of what the Brits. I think Britain is a fantastic country. It's a wonderful place, a welcoming place. It's just you don't hear it because we live currently in a climate where the press doesn't want you to hear that.
They've got their own narrative, haven't they?
Yeah. My father would always say, you know, God will never forget, you know, the kindness of these people. We moved to Northwich in this, I think it was an old people's home converted for us to stay. And then suddenly we had all this space. I had like a playroom with toys and a games room. And my mum had a sort of restaurant style kitchen when she was cooking. So it was extraordinary times. And we've gone from sort of, but again, even my dad would just spend his day sort of, I think that's when the post-traumatic stress hit my mum and dad, my family. And we weren't aware of that. We sort of just normalized it. But I remember my mum just crying every day, just every single day. All I remember of my mum during that time is just her in tears day and night. One of the things that war does to you is it's your feelings, your empathy, your all of that evaporates. You're sort of left with this, like you have nothing. And the way I describe it for me is I learned to sew back feelings into my soul, because I had, everything had gone. I would watch stuff and feel nothing. Whilst I was there, I joined year 8 in school. I was the only foreigner in the secondary school in Northwich. And I remember joining school, and they were really lovely. The school was amazing. They were just so welcoming. I had this guy called Adam and John, I think it was, these two kids who would pick me up from my residence where we were, the old people's home, and we would walk to school. And it was so lovely. But I remember the first lesson, the bell rang and everyone just ran out. But I had never had that in school in Kosovo. Like we were in, you know, we had all our lessons in this cold room. So I remember thinking, where do I go now? Like, I didn't know that you had to change rooms and stuff. I also remember my mum said, whatever you do, don't eat pork. They have pork on everything. So I remember going to lunch to the canteen and just going, oh my God, there's pork everywhere. So I just ate chips and gravy every day. We stayed June, July, August in Northwich. And then my brother said, look, we've got you a flat in London. I want you guys to be near me. London is where you want to be. So we moved down to London, and sort of that's when we started living a more of a normal life. My brother registered me to a secondary school in London, and then we just sort of started to connect with the Albanian community in London. So my mum and dad started making some friends, but things were not great either, because new difficulties arose, you know. So like my mum and dad had to go and see a doctor. So they needed a translator. So I had to go and translate. So then I started taking care of them in that way. So I would go to school in the morning and then rush back to take my mum to the GP. And then my mum would say some all sorts of horrendous things for me to translate. And I remember thinking, if I tell the doctor what she's saying, they're going to take her away from me, you know? So I remember sort of not saying the truth. My mum was just, I don't think my mum was very well at the time, was just sort of saying stuff that made no sense. She was just depressed, and I think she just needed to speak to people. But as I was a child, thinking that I'm doing the right thing. And
yes, a lot of responsibility and burden on you.
So and it was just soul-destroying hearing your mum and dad say this, you know, horrible things of what they were feeling and experiencing. But then what happened was school was different in London to school in the north, because this was a very multicultural school, but it was a very racist school. There was a lot of xenophobia, so when I started going there, I started experiencing kids coming up to me going, go back to your effing country. I would walk to school and there was this like, hot spots where you'd get robbed or mugged as a child. But I couldn't tell anyone because I had like mum and dad at home who were just constantly crying. I had brothers who were busy. So I have to deal this on my own. And that ordeal was just, it was the hardest thing. So I was like, I was dreading it. You know, I didn't want to be there. All I wanted to do was go back to Kosovo and be in my own home. And, you know,
How did you deal with it then?
I had this Walkman that I took from my brother, this like old school Walkman with a tape, and I had this all this nostalgic Albanian songs, and I would put that on and just walk. And I remember there was this stretch where you cross the North Circular in North London from Brent Cross, and when you got to the top, it was very loud because of the cars, and I remember singing at the top of my lungs on this like all this patriotic Albanian songs, and trying like to get the like crying and trying to get like my emotions at. But what happened was I was hitting, you know, I was being a teenager. I was hitting puberty and hitting and becoming a sort of a young teenager. And that your emotions are heightened anyway. And then eventually sort of end up going to college and left school. And that's when things just changed. The biggest problem I faced was this, as a child, I was just this desperate need to fit in. Like I just desperately wanted to belong somewhere, to fit in, to think that, okay, I'm fine here. Yeah. And I never got that for a long time. I never experienced that feeling of, oh, I belong here. It was just a weird feeling of I'm living here, but I don't really feel like I belong here. But, you know, and then we weren't able to visit Kosovo because our status hadn't changed, and we were in this limbo where we weren't sure if we're going back or not. So there was all this uncertainties and all of that sort of reflected in me growing up very confused, like where do I belong? Mm-hmm. But eventually when I started going to college and I met a new group of friends who were just all in it, they were all young, 17-year-olds, all trying to, you know, to do things, to show off their music and their fashion and their clothes. And I sort of formed a group of people that, you know, they're still my friends now. But I remember desperately trying to fit in and sort of making things up. And for example, a friend would say, oh, I went to see, I don't know, Placebo, a band, last night, and they were amazing. Yeah. And I would say, oh, I saw Metallica. And I would say something similar to sort of in my desperate need to fit in.
Yes.
But this sort of escalated because I started making stuff up.
Yeah, of course, you'd get caught out, wouldn't you?
And I started lying, basically. I started lying to fit in. And it got to a point where I started being scared because I was thinking, am I having a personality disorder here? Like, am I, you know, and it was it's another thing that happens, you know, to people and who have that dysfunctionality happening, you know, the messed up childhood. And I had this emotional breakdown. I remember just everything going dark and just collapsing because I had this thinking, I had this girlfriend at the time and I was telling her, you know, trying to think that I'm free now from, and obviously if you tell someone that you're a liar, they're obviously not going to like it. So everything, I remember just everything, I was thinking that this is the end of everything. I'm not who I am, blah, blah, blah. And I remember I had collapsed and my girlfriend had taken me to hospital. And my brother had called my brother who had come to pick me up. And I remember waking up in this like hospital corridor in King's Cross in London. And the doctor asking me what was wrong with me, and then I'm trying to speak and nothing was coming out. I couldn't, no words were coming out. I just could not speak. And then they checked that I was okay. They said I need time to rest. And then my brother just looked after me for about 2 weeks, where he would just come visit me, feed me some soup. And then he would take me for walks. And then eventually I started speaking. But for me, it was like a reawakening. Like when that happened was sort of where everything settled. It was like one of those points where it culminated to that breakdown where everything got too much, family having a role, you know, all the flashbacks of war, everything just sort of culminated into that breakdown. That was sort of what I thought was the line, but I think it was a culmination of all these events that led me to my brain just going, well, I can't take this anymore, just collapsing. And then reawakening as a, it was a weird thing where I woke up and I can't nowadays. I mean, I can tell a fib, but I can't lie. I cannot possibly lie anymore. So that sort of reset me into a new character, a new, I started building me, who I am today, where, and it was great because I never ever had a bad episode or feeling down or feeling, it was just from then on, it was just, I'm so lucky to be alive. It's amazing. I'm so privileged. And it was just full on energy and it's been great. The thing is that for numerous years, I didn't speak about what my experience was like because I couldn't, because it's so deep and so, you know, it involves, and also I was quite emotional telling it. It took me a while to sort of build a distance, an emotional distance to sort of see things clearly and then speak about them. When I used to have grim, like when I heard like little bits of war commentary of someone my age, I used to be obsessed with it because I wanted to know what it's like for other people who were in a conflict, what it was like. Do they talk about these things? And no one really does. You see, when you hear a war now, a story of refugees and children, you hear it in the news and they give you the context and they give you the he said, she said. But no one goes back now and tells you, oh, the guy from Syria that you saw in the news 10 years ago, like this is what happened. No, you don't hear the stories at all. True. So you never hear that. Just because you've been to a war, it ends. These things carry on. They break families apart. People end up doing all sorts of stuff. They become different characters, different people. And war does that to you. It's not a great thing, you know. I would have liked to have been an Albanian living in my home in Kosovo. But I'm not. But it's fine because you learn to cope. You learn to become you. And but I think it's important that more and more people who experience conflict, who experience, especially people who are young, because I think when you're a certain age, you already know yourself and you can maybe deal with things better. But when you're at a young adolescent or a child, these things have enormous, enormous impact on you growing up. And you know, I still, you know, do things. For example, my wife, when I first met her, she bought a present for one of her good friends and it was the right present because they loved it. And she was crying with tears of joy because it was, and I remember just sitting there going, I don't have this. I want the same. Like, you know, I want to feel. And when this thing happened, I realized when I was like, okay, I'm okay now. I was watching MasterChef in the UK.
Yeah.
And this guy was my favorite and was doing very well. And in the end, he made it to the final and he always used to forget seasoning, but this time he seasoned everything. And then it was the culminated into this, like he was the champion. And I remember me crying because he had seasoned his dish properly. I was thinking in my head, I was thinking, okay,
I'm healed.
I'm normal now.
Yeah. Have you been back to Kosovo?
I have. And, the most extraordinary thing, happened when I went back first time, I got a stateless passport, a refugee passport, and I was allowed to go back to Kosovo. And first thing I did was go to my mum's and dad's house. And I remember just getting there and everything was tiny. So, cause when I left, I was a 12-year-old child and I had grown. So I remember it took 10 steps to get to the light to turn. Now I can just reach it. You know, I used to have like to bring a step and to reach the light in the living room, and now everything was like here and everything's small, and it was just seemed everything was so different in that sense. And And it also, I realized that I don't belong there. That longing that I grew up thinking I want to be in this house, and I'm realizing that I no longer am this person. I had changed. I wasn't anymore. I was sort of a tourist in my own country. So it was very tough. It was very hard to take in, because this love, this longing love and nostalgia that I had built for back home wasn't there.
Yeah.
And I was, this thing that I was fighting to get wasn't there. And I was like, what is it? And it was just me growing up differently, growing up in a different society and integrating in a different world. But it took me a while to realize that. It took me a while that actually I have an Albanian past, an Albanian root, and I should celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a British upbringing and a British way that I've been brought up in that I should too celebrate, because yeah, it saved me. So it's realizing that took a while, because obviously, you know, I'm not an expert, and you know, and you, after a few drinks or whatever, you have a few ups and downs, and you realize these things. But it takes time. You have to fight when things were dark and blue. That you have to find a way, and I think partly you do that because of the position you're in as a refugee. You have no choice. But also, I think it's something to do with where I come from, with that Albania. They have this spirit, this where people just don't give up and fight, and when you're oppressed, you have that energy, that belief that nothing can bring you down. I've never given this to anyone, but
oh, really?
I've never really opened. I've written about it in details and here and there, and I've written about one part, which was mm-hmm. that what happened in that journey, the train journey,
yes,
from the station to the border. But I never really opened up into what happened after and things like that. So you have an exclusive.
Oh, I'm very honored. Thank you so much.
But I hope it helps. I just hope people hear it. I want people to hear and to humanize refugees, because they shouldn't fear people who are refugees or people who are seeking safety. These people are normal. And, you know, they're not there to steal jobs or steal benefits or things like that. People, this, you know, these are humans. And we, I think in today's world, we're missing the human side of this. We have completely dehumanized refugees and people who are fleeing persecution. We think that they're somehow after our own, they're going to come in our villages and take our jobs. They're not going to do that. People just, you know, we should just take a step back and realize that humanity, sometimes, you know, we need to be human and help each other. So
well, a huge thank you to Hassan for talking to me today and raising awareness of the everyday realities of war for children. I feel heartbroken for the young Hassan and the millions of children out there who are experiencing the ravages and unjustness of wars they didn't ask for. Thank you for listening to Unseen Legacies of Childhood. If you like this episode, please do like, share and follow. This enables me to bring you more fantastic guests with truly fantastic stories. Life isn't easy, and if you feel you'd like to talk to someone, please do check the show notes below for links to organisations who can help. Next time on Unseen Legacies of Childhood.
Looking back now, that was probably just symptomatic of how things were going to change between me and him. And he from that moment saw me as a woman rather than as his daughter. Rebuilding my life was feeling that I should put something back, and I wanted to try and be there for other people.